Hello, and welcome to the Back Issue Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about an older comic book storyline.
In this Back Issue Spotlight, I'm joined by Sam, and we are going to be discussing Zero Hour Crisis in Time, published back in 1994. Sam, how you doing tonight?
I am well, John. Glad to be here.
Cool. Now, which version of this did you read? Did you read the issues, the trade, what?
I grabbed the issues 4 through 0 off of DC Universe Infinite, and then I decided to pull my omnibus off the shelf and start it. And I am currently somewhere between issue 3 and 2, reading an issue of The Adventures of Superman.
Okay. Interesting.
But I finished the issues themselves.
Right. The 4 through 0 of Zero Hour itself. Okay. Interesting. I just read the trade, which had the prequel story from Showcase 94's number 8 and 9.
Yep.
And then Zero Hour, 4, 3, 2, 1, and 0. Now, of course, back in 1994, I had read everything that was coming out at DC for the most part. So similar to that omnibus experience you're getting now, you know, it makes me think there's really almost three vantage points to look at this story from. There's the reading I just had, which was kind of the isolated, just the miniseries, which is out of context and, ironically, out of time.
Yes.
There's the reading you did of that with the omnibus, so you were at least getting the tie-in issues around it.
Mm-hmm.
So you had the fuller context, but it, too, still being, what, 25 years out of time.
Mm-hmm.
And then the reading I had back in 1994, where it was the then-current continuity, I was up on everything and reading it all as it was happening. And I recall liking this story more then than I did this time around, and I didn't dislike it. It was fine this time. But, man, I was reading this, and I kept thinking, where was this at in Superman's timeline? What was going on with the Batman family at this point? You know, what was going on with the Legion of Superheroes and so forth? And just really not being able to kind of solidly anchor it in a lot of those timelines.
I somewhat feel the same. However, this, somewhere around here, possibly a few years before this, is probably when I was most heavily in the DC universe. So leading up to this, I'd probably, to be fair, it's been, you know, whatever, 30 years almost now. Wow.
This was 94, so 25-ish?
25. I probably read just about every DC book a year and a half to the 2 years before this.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's been those 25 years. Rereading this, it's interesting. Some of it I've really enjoyed. Some of it, particularly when I get into some of the tie-ins, the tie-ins are interesting. They have the Batman books, but not many of the other major DC books are represented in the tie-ins. They're more the, you know, the Outsiders, the Dark Stars, Legionnaires, Valor, Hawkman, Justice League Task Force, the Legion 94, the acronym one, Team Titans. So it's been interesting kind of reading through some of those.
Well, and there are a couple of those that I think are a lot more, I was going to say central to the storyline, but it's not really it. I mean, like the Hawkman stuff, there are definite ramifications here to that character.
Well, as every event unfortunately seems to be.
I would say this one impacted Hawkman a little bit more than many of the others.
Fair enough.
And there were a few others that it's like I can't imagine. Well, and again, having just read it without having reread those issues, I kind of can't imagine, I guess. You know, you don't really get the full picture.
No, exactly. Which is why I've gone back, and like I said, I'm not quite complete, but that's why I started after, you know, I had read it all and was ready for this episode, and I kind of went, Yeah, I've got 2 or 3 days. Let me see how much of the rest of this stuff I can get caught up on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's good that you did that, because I think you're going to have, obviously, a fresher memory of some of those stories than I will. But as a standalone miniseries, out of context, out of the time period, this is interesting, this is good, but like I said, not as good as when I was in the thick of it and it was, you know, in the moment. And this is, I mean, part of my feelings on that is this is another true kind of crisis of the DC universe where things change for some characters pretty substantially in some cases.
Hopefully you'll be better at pointing those out, because that's what I was kind of trying to figure out. And, you know, there's towards the end, there's like, oh, we've remade the universe and, you know, there's some substantial changes. None of them were pointed out, and I can't quite put my finger on what some of them might have been.
I would say the major ones, and again, I'm doing this from memory, Hawkman's status quo changed.
Okay.
He is now, or as of this point in time, because of course they've changed it many times since, it's not a question of was he the Golden Age Hawkman or the Silver Age Hawkman. He was like every Hawkman ever.
Yes, they all make an appearance, that's for sure, as time's kind of going in and out. There's that one great splash page in one of the issues, it's either 4 or 3, where we see, like, I don't know, 10 Hawkmen with all the different outfits and
that was in
variations.
Number 4, yeah, where he kind of, okay, like, yep, multiplies out. But then, yep, in a later issue, I think it was 3, they all seem to merge into the then-current Hawkman.
Okay, I couldn't tell if they were fading or merging, but okay, fair enough.
And that got clarified in his title.
Yeah, a little bit.
Because this was a little while, about a year or two after the Hawk World 3-issue miniseries, which then spawned an ongoing title that Hawkman, I think, was in at the time of this. And they had basically rebooted Hawkman, you know, after Crisis and stuff like that, actually a few times. So prior to going into Zero Hour, he was an alien cop who had no connection to the, you know, JSA version of Hawkman, other than similar look, powers, similar sounding, although very differently spelled name. And they'd kind of messed up his continuity enough that this attempt to kind of simplify it was, yeah, he's all of them.
Yeah. And it's interesting because one of the tie-in issues I have read, which is between 4 and 3, is Hawkman 13.
Mm-hmm.
And most of that is he's the cop in Chicago, and he's fighting Godspawn, this kind of hawk avatar, mm-hmm, almost. And really the tie-in's kind of at the very end as he kind of gets swept into where he really was in 4.
Mm-hmm. And I think the next issue goes into kind of what the ramifications are.
Fair enough.
I think. Another group that was really impacted by this was the JSA.
Yeah, obviously, yeah.
They had been, prior to this, kind of magically or mystically, you know, younger than they should have been. In the events of issue 3, they kind of, you know, catch up to the senior citizen age they ought to have been, for the most part, with Alan Scott seeming to be the major exception to that.
Yep.
And then, I'm trying to think, who was the other one that was one of the main changes here?
Well, I was going to ask you, we do see that sequence where they are still old, but they're told they're going to live, basically. Mm-hmm. And Starman passes on the cosmic rod.
Yes, to his son, David.
To his son, David. Is this about the time that series started, or
this
was
is
that
what,
much later?
This is what leads into the Starman series starring Jack Knight.
Knight, yeah.
And note, it's David Knight that's given the cosmic staff at this point, or rod, whichever it was at the time. And he doesn't last long, and his brother takes over.
Yep, no, and that's that. But that is the status quo in issue 0 or 1 of that Starman series.
Yeah, so that was another character that came out of this fairly different. And really, the other group that was a huge, huge change out of this, unless I'm confusing it with another one of the major reboots, and I might be, was Legion of Superheroes. I believe it was after this that Mark Waid came in and completely rebooted the series.
Okay, yeah. Again, there's some Legion crossovers I've read. They seem to be a little meandering and odd.
this was one of the more confusing points for the Legion. Going into this, they were in the post 5 years later era, I believe. And again, I'm doing all this from memory, so if I'm a little off, forgive me. But we had an older adult-ish Legion of Superheroes.
Yep.
We had a younger batch of clone Legion of Superheroes, the SW6 batch. So at one point here, we have, and I forget if it was issue one or whichever one it was, we've got the three founding Legionnaires, I think it was issue one, the older set, the clone batch, and Time Trapper sitting there. So again, we've got two competing versions of the Legion of Superhero going into this, and if I recall correctly, because it doesn't actually happen in here, they all kind of, in story continuity, you know, sacrifice themselves. And we get a little of that here, I guess, with what happens there at issue one. And out of it comes a brand new 30th century with the then revised Legion and Legionnaires series.
Well, and it's interesting because, again, let me double check where it's at here. It is between issue 4 and issue 3 is Legionnaires 18. And it looks like Wade took over, well, with Legionnaires 17.
Yeah, because I'm thinking at that point, the younger group was the Legionnaires title and the older group was the Legion, maybe? I don't remember.
It's interesting because the Wade story in 17 and 18 are in here.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to like DC Universe and just look up Legionnaires 18, it says continued from Legion of Superheroes 60. And that is written by, both of those are written by Mark Wade.
Mm-hmm. But they didn't include that one?
Not in the omnibus, no.
Interesting.
It actually looks like Wade takes over with Legionnaires 16.
Okay.
Which is May of 94.
Got it.
And then he did a annual, and then 16 and 17, and continued from there. So yeah, it was right around the same time.
Yeah, and that was, again, a complete restart of that franchise.
Yeah, and then it looks like the other Legion, the younger cloned ones, end at number 70 with the tie-in issue, and it looks like those were being written by Tom Pyre at the time.
That sounds right.
And like I said, they seem to, that book seems to end with this crossover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, if I recall correctly, and it's 50-50 if I do, and a part of my problem here is, this is one of many retoolings, revamps, retcons, reboots, however you want to phrase it, and I think some and all of those terms apply to the various ones, where they said, you know what, we've messed up our story continuity, we're gonna clean it up, move forward from here.
Yep.
And, you know, sure enough, 5-10 years later, they're back in that same position.
Well, part of it is they keep messing it up, but I think another part of it is they go, okay, we're starting fresh here, and they tell some stories, and then either a new editor or a new writer comes and has fond memories of the previous versions and goes back to wherever they choose and try to bring those elements in. And so now you've got two versions, you know, until they get to where they have five versions competing again, and they go, oh, we got to start over again. And that lasts until that editor or writer leaves.
But there's definitely an aspect of pendulum swinging back and forth. Somebody thinks something's broken, so they go in and quote-unquote fix it. But then a new editor or creative team comes in and says, I liked it the way it was before, and they fix it. And then another one comes in and says, no, I liked it before you fixed it.
Yep.
So some of that goes back and forth. But there's also aspects of this where there is just change for the sake of change.
Okay.
Because, like, Guy Gardner going into this has alien power armor, I believe it was, and coming
yes.
out of this, totally different power set.
But, yes, but I would argue a lot of that was specifically set up for this and because of this. The alien armor came about because of the fight with Hal Jordan, and that is kind of concluded in this series. And he is reset back to the warrior, or he becomes the warrior at that point?
He becomes, I think, at that point. I don't think it was a reset.
Fair enough.
Because I think prior to the armor, he was going with a Sinestro ring, wasn't he?
I'm trying to remember, because this is after the death of Superman. So, because I remember the Gold Lantern that was in the JLA at the start of the Doomsday fight.
Yeah, not a Gold Lantern. The only Gold Lantern we've ever seen is currently with Bendis's Legion. But there was a Yellow Lantern.
Okay, whatever. He was kind of by himself. Yes, he was his own unique thing.
Yeah, because this is, of course, long before we've got the Sinestro Corps.
Yes.
So I think Guy was running around with, it might have even been Sinestro's ring itself.
It might have been, yeah.
And part of it is, over the decades, they go through so many revamps of these characters, it's hard to keep track where they were when.
Yes.
And it was interesting, because I think it was issue 3, there was a really nice 2-page splash of all the heroes gathering.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at that, and I'm like, man, by today's standards, there's a couple of these that are pretty obscure characters.
I would argue there's quite a few. Let me pull up that page. You say it's in issue 3?
Yeah, it's in issue 3. I'm trying to remember how far. It was nearish the beginning, so maybe 5 pages in or something.
Like the big splash page with Wonder Woman kind of front and center?
Yeah. I say it's a nice splash page in terms of I like the layout and the concept. I'm not going to say the art in this series was brilliant. I mean, there are a couple of places where we get Ordway where it was. This was not one of those pages.
I'm a huge Dan Jurgens fan, so I'm a little kinder to the art in this series than you. That being said,
doing the art or just the writing?
And that's where it gets weird. He's listed as the art, sort of. More like breakdowns, and then Ordway is just listed as the anchor. That being said, the Dan Jurgens I really love is the more modern one that's inked by Norm Ratman. But you can see parts of Ordway in this, and you can see parts of Jurgens in this.
Don't get me wrong. I like Jurgens as an artist. Ordway's amazing, too. This is not up to either of their standards.
I tend to agree. I don't think their styles meshed particularly well.
Yeah. But this is, again, kind of the gathering of the heroes and such. And there were a few in here that it's like, yeah, I recognize. There was one I had to actually do a little digging to go figure out who it was.
Okay, because I'm looking at this and there's 2 or 3. I'm not sure who they are.
Ask away.
Who's the orange one on the far pink, bright pink on the far right?
That's Despero, who used to be a JLA, a longtime JLA villain. At this point, I believe he was inhabited by Elron, which was the robotic assistant from the Bendis DeMatteis Wahaha era.
That one I don't remember.
He was essentially their stand-in for the Savage Dragon, I guess.
Yeah. I don't remember Booster exactly looking like this. I know it's Booster. I recognize him, but
he went through a phase where he had more of an armored kind of a thing because he couldn't use modern tech to kind of rebuild his suit properly.
Yeah. That one's unusual. I don't remember Power Girl's pregnancy at
neither,
all.
That one I totally spaced on too, and I don't know most of the creators who use the character have remembered it either.
Fair enough. Yeah, I mean, most of the rest of them I recognize, but in some cases I went, oh yeah, that's who that is. I don't remember that look. There's a lot of that.
The ones that I think were the more obscure ones were over on the far left. We've got the one with the A on him that's Alpha Centurion.
Yep.
He's sitting next to Elongated Man, who's got the then current costume, but not one of his iconic ones.
Yep.
Between Martian Manhunter and the Ray is Triumph.
Yep.
Who was essentially created to be a lost in time character. Over kind of behind Superman and Geo-Force is Amazing Man. This is the grandson of the Amazing Man from All-Star Squadron. He's, I think, a Justice Leaguer at this point.
Ooh, there's another one I don't recognize. I didn't even notice before. Who's the guy in the cloak with the blue face kind of between Superman and Alpha Centurion and right there?
I'm pretty sure that's Phantasm of the New Titans.
Fair enough, okay.
Between Superman and Superboy back there is Agent Liberty.
Yep.
The one that had me stumped for a little bit was the green guy next to Superman. That turns out to be Emerald Dragon.
Yep.
Who turns out to be Ultra Boy.
Yes. Having just read a couple of those Legion issues, yes. That one I knew because of that.
That one, 25 years later, I'm like, who the hell is that? Because I had seen the character below him in Saturn Girl, which is Gunfire. And I'm like, oh, yeah, there's the Blood Ties characters or whatever they were. Maybe he's one of those. But, yeah, some of them, whenever they do these kinds of crossovers, everyone who's got, you know, an active title or can be, you know, justifiably pulled into one shows up. And then if they don't have one, they're not seen in next year's crossover or the one after.
Yeah. Well, there's even an issue. And here's the funny thing. It's issue 23 of Valor. Mm-hmm. I don't remember that being a title that long.
I think it only lasted maybe one more issue. And it was a...
I believe this is the end. 23, I believe, is the end.
Okay. It was one of the many things they did to kind of gloss over there not being a Superboy in the modern era and him being a key factor on the Legion's continuity.
Yeah.
So they took Mon-El, who couldn't be called Mon-El because Superboy named him Mon-El, so let's give him another name, let's give him another backstory, and have him kind of be the inspiration for the Legion.
And what's interesting was I started looking, it looks like the title was started by Pete Fleming, who did like the first 10 issues, and then it looks like Mark Waid did like the next 8 or 9, and then Kurt Busiek came in and finished it up.
Hmm.
So, I mean, he had a heck of a creative team.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, some of this stuff, you just, because the titles rotate in and out so much, more so now than they did back then, but even back then there was quite a bit.
Yeah,
I mean, a number of these characters, you know, Red Wing and a few of the others are Team Titans characters.
Yep, which was also a book in some of the crossovers, yep.
Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh yeah, that was published at this time.
Well, this is, I believe this crossover is what got Damage into the Team Titans, right?
Into the Teen Titans.
Yes.
Not the Team Titans.
Let me rephrase that. At the time, it was the New Titans. That, at least that's the way this book appears.
Yes, there was, the New Titans were going on at this point, but after this, there was another Teen Titans series that the rejuvenated Ray Palmer Adam joins.
Got it.
That had mostly new characters.
Yeah.
But I think the New Titans with Damage and a few others goes on for a little bit longer. But then there was a time-displaced set of characters, including an alternate Terra and so forth, that were the Team Titans,
Titans.
That play into this story a little later as a way to just kind of shut that series down.
And I haven't gotten to it yet, but I got to admit, there is a crossover with Anima, who had at least a 10-issue series that I do not remember at all.
It went maybe 13 issues, I think.
Okay.
And I remember it was there. Vaguely remember the character. But if you had asked me when it was published, I couldn't have told you off the top of my head.
I haven't gotten to that issue yet, but I did look at it. I saw the cover and went, wow, Anima number 7's a crossover. I don't remember that title.
Every so often, I've stumbled across a page, be it on, you know, DeviantArt or somewhere else on the web, where some artists will do, you know, just sketches of characters and stuff. And there have been a few that have done, well, here's a lineup of, like, the Justice League over the years. What I'd like to see an artist like that do is kind of the group shot at the end of crossovers, just so you could see, you know, from crossover to crossover, here's how the look of Nightwing changed, or here's who was in the Justice League at this time, or, you know, which Titans showed up, or did they? Because it, the easiest way to kind of date what was going on is this kind of a splash page.
Yeah.
It's like, oh yeah, we've got Infinity Inc., we've got some Dark Stars, we've got, you know, this group of Justice Leaguers, that group of Titans, etc. So, I always find that just kind of interesting.
And it's weird. I actually am one of the people that loved the Dark Stars title. I realize that puts me in the minority. And I forgot, this is the weird part where Fenris has been imprisoned, sort of. Anyways, it's interesting. In the Dark Stars crossover, they refer to Donna several times. In the actual Zero Hour books, is she ever referred to as Donna, or do they just keep calling her Darkstar?
I think there was once or twice she might have been referred to there.
Yeah, but I mean, mostly she's just called Darkstar, particularly at the very, you know, kind of the last two issues when her and Wave Rider are really having a discussion and kind of disagreeing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, yes, Darkstar, you know, you're wrong, Darkstar, whatever.
I think it was when maybe Superman or whoever was recruiting her at the beginning of the story.
Mm, okay.
But this is where I think this story kind of falls down when taken out of context, is it was hard for me to know, in some cases, you know, to get a clear anchor and, well, which Flash is this or something? And are we being introduced to Impulse because he's not well known or because he's new to this time period? You know, are we actually being introduced to him, or is he just introducing himself to characters that don't know him? You know, those sorts of issues.
Well, and it's interesting. Besides the two showcase books,
mm-hmm.
the only book before Zero Hour number 4 in the Omnibus is Flash 94, which brings in, well, I wouldn't say brings in Impulse, has Impulse, and clearly indicates it's a fairly early point in Impulse's. You've got Iris as well as a Wallian wife, and kind of Impulse had just come out of the chamber he grew up in,
mm-hmm.
and is kind of getting used to the real world. So that gives you hopefully some context as to where Impulse was when this story started.
Yeah, I was pretty sure this was, you know, like within a few months of him being introduced.
Yeah, it looks like he started in Flash 92. And like I said, the crossover right before Zero Hour Zero is 94.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, just exactly a couple of months.
Yeah, yeah. And this was a fun era of the DC Universe and stuff.
Yeah.
But, man, again, reading it, you know, a quarter century removed from it. And part of it is, there were things that happened in these issues of Zero Hour that really get expanded on and explored more elsewhere.
Yes.
You know, the whole bit with Batgirl is kind of sort of dealt with here, but more in passing versus, you know, in detail. And then when we're first really introduced to her in issue number 4, and it's a backward number series, if anyone hadn't figured that out.
Yes, yes. It starts with 4.
She doesn't recognize the then current Robin, which I'm pretty sure is Tim Drake, but not yet, you know, 1,000% positive, pretty sure.
It is.
There's another Robin watching those events.
Yes.
And he's never seen in Zero Hour the series itself, which disappointed me. And I'm pretty sure it was a young Dick Grayson.
I'm not sure. I was trying to figure out.
I assume that one of the various Batman family title, you know, tie-in issues dealt with that.
A little bit, but it's Batman 511 for those interested. And it is the Batgirl from this series meeting the then current Barbara in the wheelchair. And the Nightwing and Tim Drake are there. There is not another Robin. So the only interplay between that Batgirl that I have come across so far and Robin that's not Tim Drake is in that Zero Hour, and some of their banter / repartee leads me to believe that's Dick when he's really young.
It has to be.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I tend to agree. It's got to be.
But this is one where even though they had some stuff kind of... It would have been nice to have a footnote there saying, go see this issue to find out, you know, what's going on with this.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's a lot of kind of Easter eggs. There's a lot of small bits here and there that if you don't get, you don't really miss anything. Like the whole Paul Manning reference in that 7500 AD scene and such.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a lot going on elsewhere in the DC Universe, you know, connected to this that not having as I reread this made this story feel a little wanting in places.
I can see that. The other thing, and obviously this probably came out of this, is when I first started, when the Spectre first appeared, before Hal appeared, I thought that was Hal and didn't realize it was still Jim Corrigan.
I think it was Final Night where he became Spectre.
Got it. Fair enough.
But that's the hard part with this stuff is where are we in everybody's timeline and when do some of these other pivotal events happen?
Yeah, exactly. And that's hard.
Because I was, until he mentioned he didn't have a human host or whatever at that point, I was wondering the same thing.
Yeah, no, me too. I kind of went, oh, is that Hal? I went, oh, no, that's... And they very clearly let you know it was Jim. And then clearly when he faces Hal, they're obviously not the same person at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's... I'm not sure how they should have written this to be better or whatever, because...
Well...
They can't footnote everything.
Well, and to be better is hard. I mean...
To be more accessible.
To be more accessible... Yeah. And again, I think it's... If you don't have preconceived... You know... Asking them to make it more accessible to those of us that have 25 more years of knowledge is, you know what I mean? It's not fair to say, oh, they should have made it clear which Spectre it was. At the time, that was the only Spectre. Or had Crispus Allen been the Spectre yet? Anyways.
No, I think he was after Hal.
Yeah, so...
No, that's a fair point, because there were fewer options to be confused with, I think.
Exactly.
But that... I guess I was looking at it not from they need to have guessed what my questions and confusions was going to be 25 years later, so much as assume I don't know who this character is, so properly introduce me.
Mm. Okay.
And that goes back to your Darkstar comment of she's just Darkstar, she's not Donna.
Yeah, that is true.
So I think they could have done better on that.
Yeah, that's fair.
I was surprised how long it took into the series for Hal or Parallax to really... be revealed to be kind of one of the movers and shakers behind the scenes.
That's really just the last two issues, right?
Yeah. Like,
no, I guess it's the final page of issue two.
At that point, I think we just see somebody picking up a power ring. I think it's not until issue one that we actually get a clear reveal. But it's a good ways into the story.
Yeah. No. Oh, you're right. All we see is someone picking up the power ring from... Yeah. We don't see Parallax until the first page of issue one, which...
At this point, it may as well have been Extent that was doing that stuff.
Yeah.
I was a little confused by the whole moving of the power ring, dropping it, crushing it, and all that stuff, and it's Alan Scott's ring.
It is Alan Scott's ring, which they did make a point about that.
Mm-hmm.
Because Alan took it off when he went to the hospital and gave it to... Who did he give it to?
Kyle.
Kyle, yeah.
Who then dropped it after getting attacked at one point, and then it got picked up and stuff. And I'm wondering if at the end of this, because they do have a little bit of a reset button for everyone who kind of died after, but the timeline then, you know, got reset and stuff, a lot of them kind of come back.
Wave Rider kind of talks about that. He's explaining it kind of towards the very end.
Mm-hmm. I was a little frustrated by that because it allowed them to kill off some characters. And one of them in particular, I thought they did some serious hand waving of, yeah, that doesn't matter.
Which like, one was that?
Hal. They kill him off back in issue 4.
Oh, well, yes. They kill off a version of Hal in the future. And then... Hal explains how he got himself safely and knew which version it was. Yeah,
but it was actually Hal, a younger version in the future, that died.
Yes, it was the Hal, the Green Lantern Hal that we all know.
Yes, the one that would later become Parallax, do all this stuff, and how he sidestepped that, I'm still unclear. I'll go with authorial intent as the explanation. I mean, there was some cool stuff here.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And like I said, it was enjoyable. I'm actually glad. I remembered not particularly caring for this series when it came out. I remember the Omnibus coming out a few years ago and me getting a pretty good deal on it and getting it and then not reading it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be honest, when you suggested it, I was like, yeah, okay, well, I own it. I might as well read it. And I wasn't overly excited about it, but I actually really, really enjoyed reading it, and it's fun, and it's crazy, wacky comic bookiness, and as long as you don't ask too many questions, it is kind of fun.
Yeah, And, of course, part of my nature is to ask too many questions.
Yeah, me too.
But I can still have fun with the series while doing that.
Yeah, exactly.
The other one that we may want to read following up a little on this is The Kingdom.
Sure.
Because I had been thinking, because this is, again, just one of many reboots of the DC Universe. And given what's going on in the present day with the end of Dark Knight's Death Metal, with Future State, with this whole Infinite Frontier stuff, and this Everything Happened, Everything Mattered stuff, and here's another case where they were trying to make everything matter and everything happen and stuff. But it was Kingdom, which was a follow-up to the Kingdom Come series, where they introduced Hypertime. And that was another one that was a then attempt to get around all the kind of continuity mistakes they continually make.
Where did Vanishing Point and Wave Rider start? Do you know?
Yes. Wave Rider started in the Armageddon 2001 stuff from 1991.
Okay.
And that's where they basically used the annuals to go look forward as to what's going to happen with all these characters then being published.
Okay.
And find out one of them was going to turn out to be the Monarch, this big, bad, evil guy. The Vanishing Point may have come between then and this, because this is, again, 1994 this came out, with the introduction of the Linear Men, which I think predate this series by maybe a year.
And I was going to ask you about that, because I do not see a Linear Men title anywhere around this time period. And
I don't think they ever had their own title.
Exactly. And they don't seem to appear in anywhere. They appear for one page in one of the Legion crossovers. But other than that, they only kind of appear in the few pages in this. I'm like, I have no idea who these people are, why they're relevant. And the fact that Extant is able to just kind of wave his hand and do away with all of them in a page means they're not that important, but
I'm trying to remember where they mainly showed up. If it was some Superman stuff, if it was Booster Gold, or where. And again, it's been 25 years, so I don't remember off the top of my head. But some of the members were Rip Hunter, well-known time traveler of the DC Universe. Wave Rider, who became well-known through the Armageddon 2001 stuff. Matt Rider, who was this timeline version of what would have become Wave Rider, but Wave Rider basically precluded his own future or his own timeline and such. Then there was Hunter, who may have been an alternate timeline version of Rip Hunter, but I'm not sure of that. And then there were maybe two or three others.
So the guy with Wave Rider at the very beginning of this series and in the showcase issues before it, that is not Rip Hunter?
At the very beginning of this, I think that is... the Hunter with the eye patch is not... Well, it's not the current day Rip Hunter.
It's not the traditional one I think of, because I just assumed that
it
was Rip
may
Hunter.
Be a later version of him. I honestly don't remember off the top
Got
of my head.
Got it.
I'm assuming it's an older timeline version of him, but who can keep track?
And I am glad they included those showcase pieces in the trade, at least, because the explanation of, even though it changes twice in the series, the explanation of the original Hawk becoming that character is kind of interesting.
It is, but I felt like Hunter and Wave Rider kind of immediately forgot about these events from that prologue stuff by the time we see him at the Vanishing Point in issue number 4.
That may be true, but they do when they first, well, I didn't say first, when they re-encounter him, I know at one point Wave Rider, right before Exiton, like, reveals himself to be Wave Rider, he's like, oh, you're just Hawk. And then he goes, no, I'm you.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting reveal, but then kind of immediately undone by the next issue.
Well, yeah, and then Hal kind of comes in and goes, and none of you matter.
Yeah. Well, and part of it is we're seeing time travelers out of sequence in their timeline.
Yes.
So we're seeing, you know, an earlier version of the Hawk, Monarch, Extant character, and a later version kind of, yep, that's when it's happening, so let me go do this.
Yeah.
So there's some definite time shenanigans going on here.
That being said, I tried a little bit, honestly, not too hard. Did those timestamps have any relevance or bearing or make any sense to you?
Nope.
Okay. They just seemed random. 26 minutes ago, 12 minutes ago. Not like I tried with like the first issue trying to put them in order. Like none of this makes any. They just seemed randomly thrown on the page.
That's another one where I think a remastered version in quote unquote chronological order could be interesting. It may not work at all, but it could be interesting.
Yeah, that's the thing. I'm not convinced it works at all. There's a part of me that's like, oh yeah, throw some of those, just sprinkle some of those boxes every time there's a scene change.
There was an aspect to some of the writing here that I think was in that fast and loose mindset.
Yeah, and again, I really like a lot of Dan Jurgens' work, but this is not the tightest written thing he's ever done, that's for sure.
No, but I think it's also a matter of when you do this kind of a line-wide event, you've got certain rails you've got to play within and certain things you just have to set up that other people are going to let play out.
Yeah, that's true as well.
So, I mean, there's a lot of things to do. I mean, there were a couple of things here that I'm not sure what the intent was. Like when we get Dr. Mist or whatever at one point here.
Mm-hmm.
And he's basically in this story long enough to get wiped out.
Yes.
And I think the whole point of that was to set up a power vacuum that the Primal Force would later go fill.
Okay.
Because that character prior to this, I think maybe one of his most notable appearances was in the probably out of continuity Super Friends comic.
Okay.
I think he was also in maybe an issue or two of DC Comics Presents.
Do you remember Entropy existing as a character before we see him here?
No, not really.
Fair enough. And then we later find out he's what, Rock? One of the Legionnaires, right?
Oh, Time Trapper, you mean.
Is it Time Trapper?
Time Trapper. Absolutely, I remember Time Trapper.
Fair enough. No, I remember Time Trapper. I just don't remember the Entropy character.
Well, and that was one of the other kind of big changes here is prior to this, we had never known who Time Trapper was. So for it to be Rock Kryn, an older cosmic boy,
yeah,
was a big deal.
Okay.
And then at the end, when we see the Time Trapper again, it looks like it may be a female.
Yes.
And that does play out later in Wade's Legion stuff.
Okay. Yeah, because it shows up in one of the Dark Star crossovers where literally Donna like comes face to face with Entropy and they sit there and they have a conversation. And I'm like, I have no idea who this is. And then later into this series is where it's revealed to be Rock or Time Trapper, all of that.
Okay. I don't think they used the name Entropy for the Time Trapper character here.
Okay. And again, maybe that's only in that Dark Stars crossover issue.
Yeah. But I think that's, again, one of the challenges with a story this big. You know, you drop some stuff here and there, and if you miss an issue, sometimes it you're missing that one piece to get you from point A to point B.
Yeah.
So, you know, they did some interesting stuff here, and again, the DC Universe had gotten to a point where they needed to do some cleanup. But for me, that's a matter of continuity being mishandled, specifically mishandled in terms of, it's not just you've got to know what happened before, but you've got to think about what you're doing now, the stories you're telling today, how that will impact or could impact what you may want to do tomorrow or somebody else may need to do tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, and again, this is one of those things where Hal Jordan is the big bad of this story. That's a pendulum that swung back and forth. No, Hal's the hero. So we've got to kind of undo some of this, put him back as a hero. So it's fine to have different takes on a character, but when they become mutually exclusive or diametrically opposing takes, that's when you start having certain things swing back and forth over the decades.
Well, and it's interesting because this version of Hal really is, as you see at the very end, Hal existing like this is really what drove Green Lantern or not, a Green Arrow over the edge. He just couldn't accept it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and that was one of those things that they kind of leave on,
mm-hmm.
is Ollie just, you know, not taking it well.
Yeah.
And again, it being disconnected by 25 years, I don't remember where that character was, which title he was in and stuff at the time.
Yeah, I don't either. I can tell you just because of the omnibus here, Green Arrow 90 was the issue that kind of came out in the middle of this.
So the Grell series, was Grell on it at the time?
That issue is written by Kelly Puckett and Kevin Dooley. And it looks like the two of them had kind of, boy, right before that, now that I'm looking kind of through the app, Dooley seemed to do a lot of these. It's after Grell, though, by about 10 issues.
That makes sense.
Doug Munch did an issue. Heck, Jim Aparo did a couple of issues of art. It's all over the place. Chuck Dixon did a few issues. Well, and eventually Dixon kind of takes over.
Yeah.
So it's between Grell and Dixon in kind of a lost year there.
Well, and again, ending with Ollie that way kind of makes it feel like he's a big part of this story, and there's some ramifications for him, but I honestly didn't feel he was that central to the story.
No, he, other than, again, how badly he took the reveal of Hal, he's not really in the story at all.
Yeah.
I mean, he's standing in the background constantly. He's always in the story, in the fact that the Green Arrow is standing there, but he doesn't do much or say much other than not accepting Hal as Parallax.
The irony for me is one of the people he walks past there at the end is Arsenal.
Yes.
Which is Roy Harper, you know, the former Speedy and stuff. If anyone was going to reach out to Ollie, it would have been him. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's odd.
But, I mean, there's a lot of things that, you know, even immediately after it was written, in hindsight, you could think, oh, they should have done this, they should have done that. But there's only so much room in these stories.
There's only so much room, and ultimately, you can always second-guess something, but something has to come out. And once it's printed, published, whatever, it is what it is forever. I know, like, in a different world, jazz music is very, very improvised. But there are jazz legends who have talked about recording certain, you know, even standards, well-known songs. And they're like, once it comes out and that's what people hear over and over again on the record, you're kind of forced into that interpretation of that song forever because it's different. Once it's on the page and it is there, or, you know, published, or it's released, it is what it is, and you're stuck with that forever.
Well, and that's the part of continuity that I don't think a lot of creators and editors really appreciate. Because there's an aspect of, hey, I'm just telling a story to pass the time, and that's fine and good. But there are other stories that are going to have that kind of ramification, whether it was intended or not. And that can really limit what you can do later in some cases. And I'm sure there are some people who would then argue, oh, well, that's why continuity's bad. It's like, well, no.
No.
You know, you can't tell stories without continuity in some way, shape, or form. Otherwise, the events of the beginning of the story didn't happen by the end of the story. I mean, just that level of continuity is mandatory.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll give another example. Have you watched any of the Harry Bosch television series on Amazon?
No.
Well, it's out there and doing fairly well, and I want to say 6-7 seasons in. And what's interesting is I've been reading those books since 92-ish when they started coming out. And the television show, the first season is basically, it's a book called City of Bones, which I want to say is around book 8 or 9. And there's a lot of stuff that has happened to that character in the preceding 8 years, including his wife, the beginning of his family, his daughter, all of this. Which the show just kind of starts with is accepted. And I had a friend of mine the other day asking me about it, and, you know, because he enjoyed the show. And I was saying, oh, you should read the books. And he's like, well, you know, what about the wife? And I'm like, the books start long before the wife existed. You know, it's, and it's like, oh, yeah. I'm like, no, you know, there's 20 years here. And the TV series that you've seen started on like year 15.
Yeah. Well, and I think when you adapt something from one format to another, you got to make some changes.
Yep.
And in some cases, they can definitely be improvements. Other cases, they're just changes.
Yeah. And like I said, I don't think they made a ton of changes. I actually think they're fairly, the show I'm talking about happened to be fairly accurate. But yes, it's book 8 or 9, and it's 15 years after the first one. So if you go, hey, I want to read the first one, it's a very different character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, but, I mean, if they were to try to take Zero Hour and do, say, an animated feature on it,
mm-hmm.
I don't know how many changes they would kind of have to make just to make it accessible as, you know, be it a 2-hour story or however long they would give it. Because there's a lot of stuff here that works because we've got the context of, in some way, shape, or form, of the bigger DC universe. To try to tell it as a standalone story, that's harder.
Well, and you also have to figure out what your audience perceives as normal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, because there is the Crisis on Two Earths DC animated movie.
Yeah.
And it is not very much like either of the, you know, any, either the first JLA, JSA crossover, certainly not very much like the first time we meet the Crime Syndicate. It's kind of in its own weird place because they had to go, well, here's what the audience currently expects of these characters.
I took it as being inspired by those stories, but not a direct
sure.
adaptation versus, say, the Judas Contract stuff, which they told with both a Robin and a Nightwing and No Jericho.
Yes.
And okay, those are some pretty major changes.
Yep.
I mean, the story works, but it's a different story at that point.
Yeah, without Jericho, it's a completely different story.
Yeah. So, again, I liked what they did here, but, again, not the hugest fan of Wave Rider. And this is the character that the Wave Rider ship from the DC Legends of Tomorrow TV show is named after.
Yep.
Or at least that's what the Easter egg is about or whatever. And some of the changes that came out of the story I really liked. Others, they were just changes.
Yeah. And like I said, well, I read everything DC kind of leading up to this and around this time period. And I loved it at the time. And I still enjoy going back. It's probably not DC's high point creatively for many of these characters.
I would agree with that. At this point, I was at least 15 years in of most of the DC universe and stuff, and it was a good event, but I would not say it's, if you were going to pick the best of the events they've ever done, or the best of these creators even, nah, this isn't it.
Yeah, or even the best year or two in DC history, 94 is probably not it.
Yeah, yeah. Man, if I had to pick the best year in DC history, I'd have to do some research, but I'd probably start somewhere around the 80s myself.
Yeah, I'm probably likely to go like 87, 88. But again, coming out of Crisis, there were so many great things done.
There was, but there was also so much confusion that I'd almost lean pre-Crisis, maybe 82, 83-ish, give or take, maybe even as far back as 1980, when you got the launch of the New Teen Titans, the All-Star Squadron,
yep.
The Justice League was really good back then, Legion of Superheroes was really good. They had some great stuff.
That is absolutely fair. And again, I think a lot of that comes down to kind of where you come in. As somebody who came in around 86, 85, 86, you know, to look back, you know, we covered Man of Steel a few weeks back, year one, mm-hmm. in Batman. It, you know, for someone who came in at that period, you go, that's a wonderful period.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to your point, wherever you come in is usually going to be your sweet spot because that's what got you hooked on the medium and the stuff.
Yeah. But like I said, I mean, 90 to 94-ish is probably where I was the most involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was a fun read. Overall, I enjoyed it, but it did kind of remind me of not only how much that can change in one of these events, but how much has changed by so many subsequent events.
Yes.
And how hard it is for me these days to read a story like this out of that context and kind of get my mind back into where things were then.
Well, and as we have discussed with the last few, you know, the Flashpoint, New 52, Rebirth, this is literally at least 3 DC continuities ago.
At least.
You know, exactly. Depending on what you think of Infinite Crisis, I mean, exactly. It's at least 3 full continuities back.
Mm-hmm. And to me, that's a major problem because there are other franchises that you can set a story at different points in the timeline and get back into that point pretty easily because they haven't retold that point of the timeline 8 times.
Yep.
So, and that's something that I think is a problem DC has much more so than Marvel, because while they play a little necessarily fast and loose with aspects of continuity in terms of which war was it that Iron Man was you know, captured in and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
You have to keep the story contemporary. I don't have a problem with that. But by and large, the Marvel continuity is reasonably static and consistent over time, that you can tell stories at different points in the Avengers history as they have before, and it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we've had different originating Justice Leaguers and Teen Titans and such over the iterations, that it just gets confusing.
That's very true.
So, again, I thought this was a good read. I don't know that I would necessarily suggest somebody dive into like something as large as an omnibus for this, but I think it would give you a bigger picture of what's going on at the time than just reading the 0 Hour series itself.
Yeah, it's fun. It's great. I will say this. I did decide to get the DC Infinite app.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me very much of the Marvel Unlimited app a few years ago. Well, I haven't explored it. They seem to be, you know, doing their 6-month time lag pretty good with current stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The older stuff, and again, which is a lot bigger than Marvel's, has some gaps and holes, but there's a lot of great stuff here too.
Yeah, and I'm sure they'll fill in those gaps and holes over time.
Exactly. It's weird. What I have noticed is the Silver Age is particularly poorly represented. Like Action Comics, they've got the first 100, which not my sweet spot, but if you're into Golden Age Superman, that's kind of cool. But then they've got, you know, only 10 or 15 issues between there and like 350.
That doesn't surprise me too much, because that earlier stuff, they would have prepped through DC Archives and other reprint collections.
Fair enough.
So once you've passed that point of what they've got, you know, print ready and stuff, there's some work they're going to have to do to resurrect some of the older material.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm surprised how much Golden Age stuff, again, not my personal sweet spot.
Mm-hmm.
But for those that really want to read the Golden Age stuff, there's they've got the first 28 detectives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that stuff's here if you're interested. It's a little more expensive than Marvel at $8 a month.
Yeah, but let's face it. You could get the DC Infinite stuff for, what, $8-$9 a month. The Marvel one for, what is it, $6 or $7 or something.
Yep.
And at that point, you've got access to pretty much, I don't want to say the full history of Marvel and DC, because, I mean, like you said, there are gaps on both sides. But, you know, tens of thousands of comics across multiple decades. If you're into comics and can't find something you want to, if you're into Marvel and DC comics and you can't find what you want to read there, you're out of luck. You know what I mean? There's really nowhere else to go these days.
And I will say this. I do think one thing that DC does have kind of in its favor, and it's just true of their publishing.
Mm-hmm.
They've got most of the Vertigo stuff. They've got most, the stuff that's reached the threshold for the Black Label. They've got a lot of the early Wildstorm books, even the ones that were published by Image. Some mm-hmm. of them are in here. So there's a lot more than just the main DC universe here as well.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. So,
which is kind of cool.
Yeah, that is cool. And great way to be able to dive in deeper on some of this stuff.
Yeah.
So anything else on this?
No, I'm good.
Cool.
The March previews came out on February 24th, and the deadline for preview spotlight number 160 is the morning of Saturday, March 6th. Recording clips for the preview spotlight episodes is easy, and we've got an open submission policy for these episodes. Please send in clips to support the comics you love as often as you can. If you'd like to get email reminders for the preview spotlight episodes, you can join the emailing list on the main page of the comicbookpage.com website. And a quick reminder that we've also got the recommendation roundtable episodes going. The point of those episodes is to help people find other ways to spend their time. So send in pics of comic books, either older ones, back issues, trades, whatever, novels, television shows, movies, video games, if there's a board game you think people might really enjoy or something. Let's get that out there. We've got a lot of ways we can spend our time in helping people find things that they might be interested in. It's just a great thing to do. I've gotten a lot of clips from Billy Hogan. I want to thank him for that. It reminded me that I should really go reread Astro City and put a few other things kind of back on my radar, including a couple of novels he recommended. I've added those to my reading list. We'll see when I get to them. But we've got no deadline for these episodes. The way these episodes work is you send in one clip per pick, and that could be a particular book or video game or TV show, or it could be a series of books, anything that's kind of a unified thing. And when I get enough of those clips, I'll string them together, I'll kick out an episode. So that means if I get tons of clips, like when Billy sent me about, I don't know, an hour and 45 minutes of some great clips, that was enough for me to get two episodes put together, about an hour for one and about 45 minutes or so for the other. So that's what episodes 2 and 3 are. But if I don't get clips, it may be a while before that next episode comes out. And the reason I'm doing this is there are a lot of things hitting, like the streaming services and stuff like that, on not really a set cadence like we've got for the preview spotlight. So if you wake up one morning and say, you know what, there's a bunch of stuff I think people might enjoy, spend a few minutes, send in the clips, they get in the queue. And if it's another few months before you do the next one, that's great. But hopefully we have enough people sending in clips on a regular enough basis that we can be putting one of these episodes out every month, every other month, or something like that. So once again, the point here is just to recommend older comic books, novels, television shows, movies, video games, or anything else that doesn't really fit the format of the preview spotlight, but you really want to kind of share your love of and encourage other people to check out. So once again, there's no deadline on those recommendation roundtable clips. It's an open invitation for everybody at all times. So please send in clips when you've got something you're thinking about and share the love.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.